we get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program the chief historian at NASA, who is getting ready to wrap it up and retire at the end of this month. But we managed to get a few minutes with him first before he packs everything up and heads on out the door. We're happy to welcome Bill Berry back to downtown. Bill, how are you?
I'm great, Rich. How are you doing?
Doing very well, thanks. Are you counting the days till retirement?
If I wasn't so busy, I might be counting.
Well, that's exciting.
There's lots to do between now and then.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, well, I wanted to focus on Apollo 13. We celebrated the 50th anniversary earlier this year, and you know, it's one of those events that stands out as we look back at our space program. And by the time of Apollo 13 in early 1970, it was scheduled to be the third landing on the moon. And I know it hadn't become routine for the people at NASA, but it had in some sense for the American people, which is, it's hard to believe all these years later.
It is kind of hard to imagine that the landing on the moon would ever be sort of boring, but a lot of people found it that way. Most people looked at the Apollo program and the plan to land on the moon as a race. And okay, so we won the race in July, 1969. Now you went back to the moon in November 1969, and they broke the TV camera, so there wasn't very good TV coverage. I think by spring of 1970, people were sort of, I mean, you can't blame people. It's people busy; they have their own lives and their own things that are a priority to them. And guys landing on the moon just probably wasn't at the top of the list of a lot of people's interests.
It was a very interesting.
It was for me.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. And an interesting crew assembled, led by, at the time, one of the most experienced people in the space program, Jim Lovell, who had already been to the moon once.
Yeah, Jim Lovell, an amazing guy, number one. But he's probably one of our most experienced astronauts. He'd flown to the moon on the first trip to the moon, where we circled around the moon on Apollo 8. So he'd been there before. He's, in fact, the only human being who's been to the moon twice and never walked on it.
That's right.
there were several other Apollo astronauts who went to the moon twice, but they, on their second turn, every one of them got to walk on the moon, and Jim didn't.
And he was joined on the crew by Fred Hayes, who was making his first flight, although he had been, if I recall, the backup lunar module pilot on Apollo 11.
Yeah, Fred was a highly experienced test pilot, well-respected in the field, and was clearly in line for the rotation to go to the moon. And so he'd done this backup job on 11, and that was the usual sequence, is you'd back up a crew, and then two missions later, you'd get to fly the next mission. It was sort of how the rotation normally worked, as the chief of the astronaut office, Deke Slayton, had set it up.
And then you had, as the third member of the crew, Jack Swigert, who came in as a replacement after Ken Mattingly got sick.
Actually, of course, Ken Mattingly didn't get sick. That's the ironic part of the
right
thing. But he'd been exposed to the measles, and there was no proof that he'd ever had the measles before. And coming down with the measles as an adult while you're in space, not a good idea. The flight surgeons, grounded Jet, grounded him. So the question was, do you scrub the whole mission and wait for people to be clear on a medical front, or do you swap out an individual person? Typically, the answer would have been you swap out the whole crew and put the backups in. But they really didn't want to do that with Apollo 13 because, it was just days before launch. And so the more likely outcome was that you delay the launch. And they didn't want to do that because there's launch windows and other problems and the expenses involved. And finally, they made the tough decision to swap the backup crew member. And Jack Swigert was, I know in the movie, if you watch the movie, it seems like Jack Swigert's kind of not the most highly qualified guy and not really prepared for the mission. But he was one of the folks who led the testing efforts, the simulator development stuff for the lunar module. So he was highly qualified for the mission. So I think that's part of the reason I had confidence that he'd do a great job.
We're talking with NASA historian Bill Berry here on Downtown. Now, the launch had been delayed at least once along the way, but the launch itself went very well. But then that moment chronicled in the book, of course, in the movie, and in the memory of those of us who were watching every minute of the space program at the time. Houston, we have a problem here. What was the problem?
Well, the problem was that several years before in building the spacecraft, there had been some problems with one of the oxygen tanks that was in the service module. The service module had oxygen and hydrogen tanks that were used to feed the fuel cells, because the fuel cells would combine the hydrogen and oxygen tank water, which was a useful byproduct that they could drink or you do other things with, but also produced electricity. And so those high-pressure tanks, one of them had been damaged and in a way that people hadn't noticed, and they should have, but they, there were millions and millions of parts in a Saturn V stack that went to the moon, and this one got missed. It was basically a bomb waiting to go off. They turned some fans on that stir up the tank so they can measure the quantity and make sure it's in a proper position and that it's properly mixed. When they turned those fans on, the wires inside the tank had some damage to them, and they shorted out. So they have a spark in a high-pressure oxygen tank that causes an explosion and blew out not only that oxygen tank, but damaged another oxygen tank, which fed the fuel cells. So pretty soon they had no electrical system for the command module. Part of the problem was with this is that actually simulated some things where they had a problem with the command module, the service module, because they simulated it just about everything in the Apollo program. But nobody really considered the situation quite like exactly what happened, because the assumption was that something blew up in the service module when they were that far from home, the crew would be dead.
Right.
And there wouldn't be a rescue plane you needed to do. So suddenly they find there's an explosion, the crew has actually survived, and now what do you do? How do you get them home? Because nothing was planned for how to do that.
Well, and that's when the engineers and the mathematicians got together and decided the best course of action was essentially to use the moon as a slingshot to get around the moon to make their way back home.
Exactly. The moon's a big gravity well out there for people who are flying things around in space. And we've used planets for slingshots for various things to speed spacecraft up or to slow them down before. And so that was the obvious thing, was the slingshot around the moon. And that was one of the quickest ways to get back and the most reliable way to get back, because you didn't have to use either of the engines, at least not significantly, because we weren't sure that the service module engine would still work or if it had been damaged. And so you only had really, for a big engine, you only had the lunar module engine, which was not as powerful as the service module engine, so it's not so easy to use. And so that's what they did. They slingshot it around the moon.
And was it Gene Kranz who made the decision along the way to use the LEM, the lunar module, essentially as a lifeboat for the crew?
It's interesting. I spent a lot of time this last year listening to the tapes. Everything at Mission Control during the Apollo missions was taped, and you may remember, because I know you're a space geek like me, watching those guys at Mission Control. Well, at Mission Control, all those guys at Mission Control, they had various communication lines between each other and also with all the people in what were called the back rooms who supported them. Because for every guy you saw on console at Mission Control, there were 5 to 10 people in another room who were supporting that person. And so this is a huge network. While all the conversations on headset between those guys were taped, those tapes were archived years ago because nobody quite knew quite what to do with them. In the last year or so, a team from the University of Texas, Austin, I think it was, went and digitized those tapes as part of a study on studying stress in high-stress situations. And then somebody got the smart idea to make those tapes publicly available. So we've had those tapes to listen to. So I spent a lot of time listening to those tapes, and it's really interesting to see what happens, because the movie version of things, and I'm not knocking Apollo 13, the movie, it's a great movie, but the movie version, try to create a story that fits in a 90-minute movie.
Right.
And so a lot of things get left out. And so the decision to slingshot around the moon appears in the movie that, you know, Gene Kranz says, okay, that's what we're going to do, and draws on the blackboard. In reality, one of the things they had actually simulated before was a thing called lunar lifeboat mode. It wasn't because they expected an explosion to be survival, but it was, you know, for other reasons. And, you know, Fred Hayes had actually participated in studies on that. So as you listen to the tapes, you can hear the folks at Mission Control say, hey, lunar lifeboat. And that's kind of the code word. And Fred immediately says, got it. And so he starts going to the lunar module and firing up the lunar module to be used as a lifeboat. So that was an idea that the entire team basically, you know, came to that decision pretty quick as soon as they saw that the service module and the command module with it were you know, dying in terms of electrical power, and they wouldn't have an alternative but to use the lunar module.
So they get around the moon, they're on their way back to Earth, but they're certainly not out of the woods yet. A number of things had to happen, including having to jettison the service module. And is it right that when they did that, that was the first time they were able to see the extent of the damage?
Yeah, that's exactly true. Just before they re-entered Earth's atmosphere, the only thing that comes back to Earth, of course, is the command module, which is a pretty small piece. And it was sandwiched, you know, between the service module and the lunar module. So the plan was you drop off, the service module because you don't need it anymore. At the last minute, you drop off the lunar module because you want the electrical power from that for as long as possible. And then the command module reenters on battery power. And the battery power is pretty limited, so you wanted to be careful about how long you spent on battery power. But so they of course pop off the service module, and the crew is very carefully watching this, but they want to know because nobody's really quite sure what happened. I mean, we all know now because we've seen the pictures and we've seen the analysis and stuff, but there were still a lot of questions about what had actually happened. You know, was it the oxygen tank that exploded, and what was the sequence of events, and how much damage was done? And when the service module sort of rotated around in the dark there, and the side of it that had blown off came into view, you can hear it in the voices of the astronauts. You know, the whole side of the spacecraft missing. There's a whole panel that blew off, and there's all those you know, electrical wires and junk hanging out of it from the explosion. And of course, the question in mind is, okay, it looks like it hit the antenna, which was the high gain antenna that they used to communicate with, which had caused some problems. But also the other question is, you know, did it do damage to the heat shield on the command module?
Right.
And of course, now they knew that it might have, but they weren't sure whether it actually did or not. So big, you know, lots of drama there, even right down to the very end.
Well, and if I remember from, I guess it would have been Walter Cronkite and Wally Schirra instructing me as a young man, normally the service module would help pull away the lunar module before reentry. So how were they able to get rid of the LEM?
That's an interesting thing. They did some work on that, because normally they would have left the lunar module back. The plan would have been that the lunar module land on the surface, it leaves half of it behind on the surface, and then when the ascent stage of the lunar module, after the crew gets up there and they transfer the rocks into the command module, they would have dropped that off and left it in lunar orbit for it to eventually, you know, crash on the moon. And that's where all the other lunar module ascent stages are now. They're all crashing to the moon. From Apollo 13, of course, you know, now they've got an entire lunar module, so they've got, you know, two whole parts. And how do you, you know, get separated when there's nobody in there to operate the lunar module, and you don't know how much of the systems on the command module are going to be workable, and you don't want to use any extra power. So they came up with a really clever solution. What they did was, there are hatches on the top of the command module and at the top of the lunar module, and there's a little passageway between those. And normally that would be depressurized. What they did is they pressurized that space in there so that when they released the latches between the command module and the lunar module, there's like, you know, this expansion of the puff of air that basically pushed the lunar module away from them. So there were some concerns about how well that would work, but it actually worked pretty well. So that worked.
So especially coming just a few years after the loss of three astronauts on the test of Apollo 1, this was hugely important for the continued survival of the space program to get these guys back to Earth safely. As you look at it from the time span of 50 years, how would you rank the achievement of bringing this crew home safely in the course of all of the NASA space flights?
As the chief historian here, I would say that it's probably not as significant historically as actually landing on the moon, but within the context of the space race in the 60s, it's probably the second most important mission that was flown in the Apollo program. You can slice the data lots of different ways to look at it, but in terms of the political importance of it, it was the successful return of that crew was absolutely critical to the space program. If they hadn't brought the crew back home, it's highly likely that the Apollo program would have been curtailed much sooner. It actually was curtailed by the Nixon administration, and that's part of the issue at the time was they were already cutting. They already cut one planned lunar landing mission, Apollo 20, and then they cut two more out in the course of the Nixon administration or so. The program was very concerned, the people at NASA were very concerned that the program would have been terminated early if they hadn't brought it back. And it is, one of the real triumphs of how NASA operated and the ethos of mission control and how those folks worked together. I mean, after the Apollo 1 fire, Gene Kranz called all the people together and said, we were never having this happen again because, we're committing ourselves to keeping the crews alive no matter what. And he told everybody, he said, I want you to go back to your offices and write on the blackboard, because back in those days, people had blackboards rather than whiteboards, right? And I want you to write on the blackboard, tough and competent, because that's what we're going to be, tough and competent. And that, those years of training to achieve that objective and to build that culture really paid off in spades when the Apollo 13 accident happened. And they were able to do amazing things in the course of a couple of days to bring that crew home safely.
Bill, as we look forward now, we've seen our first partnership between NASA and a private space company. What do you think this means for the future, first of all, of manned space flight?
For human space flight, the new approach is that, it's an evolution. I think it's a natural evolution of things. In the early 60s, when we were first having, putting humans in space, we were, doing new things and cutting edge things. And that required a huge amount of money, effort, time, and attention. It was good to concentrate that stuff in one organization that could do that. We've been flying humans into space since 1961, it's still rocket science, but it's sort of well-known rocket science on how to get people from the surface of the Earth up into orbit and then back again. And it makes sense that that's not something that you need to rely on, just one small team to do. In fact, to make a more robust space program, you really have to depend on having other people do it, and not just have one organization run everything. So, NASA's perspective has been, let's let the private sector increase their role, because the private sector was involved in Apollo and Mercury and Gemini and all the other programs of space shuttle, and they built the spacecraft. It's just that they did them under extremely close supervision by NASA. Now that level of supervision isn't really necessary, and we can rely on our partners to do those things to get people back and forth. And that way, NASA can take the limited budget that we have, because NASA gets about one half of 1% of the federal budget. It's a pretty small amount of the federal budget, but it's still about $20 billion a year. So it's a pretty serious responsibility on what we do with that. The plan is that money then will mainly be spent on doing the things that the American people want us to do, which is to go out and explore space and not necessarily just fly people back and forth up to low Earth orbit. So we partner with partners like SpaceX and Boeing And there are a couple other companies that are out there working on this. A company called Sierra Nevada Corporation that's building a little sort of winged vehicle that they're going to use to deliver cargo to the space station. And it's designed at some point to expand and be able to carry humans back and forth. So there are other companies growing out there that will be involved in this, I expect, in the future as the space economy grows and as more things happen in low Earth orbit and we have more regular transit back and forth. So, and I think the logic of having NASA back off from that and focus on the exploration part of the portfolio is a really smart idea.
Bill Berry, NASA historian. Bill, it's always good to talk with you. Appreciate you making time for us as you ramp up here to these final days. We wish you much happiness and enjoyment in retirement. Hope we can still reach out and connect with you down the road.
Oh, I'd be delighted to do that because my goal is to stop being a bureaucrat and spend more time actually writing history. I have precious little time to actually do it. So I have some plans for that. I want to go fly some airplanes more, and I'd really like to spend more time with my family. I will still be very much involved in aerospace history. So, I'm always happy to talk about it.
Excellent. We appreciate it. Bill, thank you so much. As always, be well, stay safe, and we'll catch you down the road.
Thanks, Rich. It's great talking with you again.